Welcome to A Rock and a Hard Place, the podcast that explores why minerals matter, their importance to society, and the role they will play in the low-carbon future. I'm your host, Thomas Hale, a graduate student exploring the Mineral Security Nexus at the University of Delaware in the Minerals, Materials, and Society program. Join me as I speak with leading experts in the field of critical minerals to discuss some of the most pressing challenges facing society and learn more about their experience working in this emerging space. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 2 of my conversation with Dr. Linda Lawson, Senior Research Fellow at the Sustainable Minerals Institute in Australia. So I want to talk more a little bit about your research and the role of women in the artisanal small-scale mining sector. Could you tell us some about the challenges women face, but also some of the important roles women play in the sector, specifically your work in gemstones?
Well, thank you, Thomas. Yeah, in terms of ASM, this is the small-scale mining of gemstones. My PhD looked at the supply chain and women's contribution. I did a lot of work on the ground with women miners. Then I looked at women traders in Madagascar. They call these women the women in hats, and they walk around with their bags full of gemstones and will try and sell them to different people. And then what I found was that, for better or for worse, the stones are then very often in the rough to Thailand. So I went to Thailand and I spoke to women in Thailand, looking at the way in which they contribute to the value addition, cutting, polishing, making of jewelry. Thai women are some of the finest craftswomen in the world. And so I looked at women's contribution right along that value chain. And my argument was that the gemstone trade offered a ladder of opportunities for women, women's empowerment. And I saw that as both a personal empowerment, where women would be able to say yes or no to the things that were being proposed to them in terms of work and personal situations, but also economic empowerment, being able to pay and provide, often it was said to me, for their kids' education, to be able to buy the books for school, to be able to enable them to pay just small amounts of money to get them into school, and also some of the very traditionally important activities such as buying cattle, providing money to pay for funerals and so on. So this is a very powerful form of personal empowerment for women. So along this supply chain, what I found was that there were gates, and these gates could be both institutional or they could be traditional cultural barriers. So in terms of institutional barriers, women who are operating in the informal sector find it very difficult to get any finance. In fact, men and women in the informal sector, they would not perhaps be able to get any bank loans. In some countries, women are not even able to get a loan without the consent of their male partner. So that was one example of an institutional barrier. There are also these cultural barriers to women working in ASM. And not to forget that these barriers were also existing in mining in the US, in Australia, in the not so distant past. So, for example, there's a well-discussed barrier to women working underground. I don't know if you realize that in some countries in the world, women are not allowed to work underground. In Vietnam, for example, even in large-scale mining, women are not allowed to work underground. In the US, it was the case that women were brought bad luck to mining underground, and this is still considered to be the case in small-scale mining in many parts of Africa. They don't want women underground. There's many, many relationships about working underground. There are some very distressing situations for women working underground, but there's also the reality that women who are not working underground, they don't have access to the first pickings. So there's a kind of a duality there, you know. Let's look after women. Let's not make them in dangerous underground situations where they might hurt themselves. But that also means the other side of that is that, hang on, we get the best view of the stones as they come up. So this kind of double standard, which seems to be protecting women, but in fact is disadvantaging women. So that's a kind of interesting dynamic that I've seen operating there that can close some of the gates for women. The other barriers for women's involvement in successful involvement are just the same as women globally. Women are doing an extra 5 hours of work a day compared with the men. Typically, they'd go home and they'd start, you know, preparing meals for people. They'd start looking after their kids and so on. So they're juggling, just as many women are across the world. They've got an extra few hours. So that makes it difficult for them to be competitive in terms of, you know, getting the extra edge. They can't go to the meetings and so on. So, you know, there are those, what they call in our academic language, that time asymmetries.
So let's, for instance, say that we're looking at a theoretical case study of a country that you've worked in. What would be the difference in a woman working at a large-scale mining operation versus an artisanal small-scale mining operation? What are the different challenges or opportunities between the two different mining operations?
That's a great question. I'd like to talk about large-scale mining and women. To start with, there's two issues really that I have been able to identify in terms of large-scale mining. First of all, there's the number of women that are employed in large-scale mining. There's a big push to increase the percentage of women in large-scale mining. BHP, one of the world's largest mining companies, wants to have 50% women by 2025, and they're on the way, in a way. But the number of people that are employed by a large-scale mine are far less than in small-scale mining, and the barriers to entry are enormous, you know. Nevertheless, there is a crossover, I believe, which is rarely discussed. And I'd like to give you an example. We've been working through a World Bank project called the Delve Exchange with women's mining associations. And there's something called the Powerful African Women in Mining Association. That brings together all these women working in mining across Africa. And that includes small-scale mining and large-scale mining. And in really remote areas where there's small-scale and large-scale mining going on, for example, in the Sahel, in Burkina Faso, in some quite vulnerable areas, you know, very, very vulnerable to terrorism. You may have heard of mines being hijacked and so on, mining convoys. So some of the women there are talking to each other, the large-scale and small-scale mining women are talking to each other and seeing what they can learn from each other in terms of protective equipment and just the ways that they can learn from each other and provide help for each other. So that's an interesting story that hasn't been told, I think. I'd like to talk a little bit more about large-scale mining as well, though, is because, as I mentioned, women do find employment, and that's a fairly good news story for the mining companies. But where they're failing, the large-scale miners, is that they are not looking at their impact on mining communities. Large-scale mining companies are operating in remote, vulnerable communities. They should know, and they do know in every one of their documents, their ESG documents, that they need to consider the impact on women in these communities. They know this. This is written. There are handbooks galore, but a recent report by the Responsible Mining Foundation found that they are just not doing the gender impact assessment studies that are needed. They're just not doing them, even though there are tons of handbooks. They're sitting on the shelves. So you might wonder why. I did a gender impact assessment study for a company in Madagascar that is going to operate there as a large-scale mine. And some of the things that come up when you do a detailed gender impact assessment are the impact on women's livelihoods. How is this going to affect the fact that they can no longer access the forest where they went for medicinal plants and for timbers and so on? What are the impacts on young women of bringing in a construction force? I'll give you an example. One of the big large-scale mines in Madagascar brought in 10,000 young male construction workers. What was the impact on the women of the region? Well, the young girls stopped going to school. They had boyfriends. They didn't need to go to school anymore. And, you know, 20 years, this has had a massive impact on women in that town. Sure, there's been a fabulous impact in that community, and they've got a lots of great facilities, and they've done some great work with, you know, HIV awareness and so on, but the impact was not well considered. So when a company goes into these remote areas, what's going to be the impact of this massive destruction of their lands, their farmland, their gardens, their forest foraging? And what's the impact of a largely male workforce on a young woman? And what are you going to do about this? So these are things that are just not being dealt with. They know they're important, but they're not doing it.
There's a lot of things that can be said about that larger issue of saying things and doing things is a big issue, I think, in today's mining space. I do want to kind of delve a little bit deeper in this gender analysis and how women and men are impacted differently by natural disasters and climate change, especially on or near mining sites. Can you talk a little bit about climate change's impacts on mining sites and how that may impact women versus men, especially given their roles that they have to play in these operations?
Look, I think it's an area that is emerging. If you look up women and impacts of climate change, you'll see it's very disproportionate, just as the negative impacts of mining impact women disproportionately. Women tend not to get the benefits of mining, and they tend to get the negative impacts. That's what we've found. And I think with climate change, we're going to find similar things. So, for example, I spoke in one of my previous podcasts about the fact that women are pushed out of some areas to go and pursue small-scale mining because traditional agriculture is not working. But I'd like just to reflect on my own personal research and thinking about this. Of course, I understood that, yes, climate change impacts women differently and so on and so forth. But it wasn't until I did a little bit of research that I had that moment of deep realization. And I was doing some reading and I looked back to some studies that had been done of a huge cyclone in Bangladesh in 1991, which, you know, had a massive impact. It was, I think, between 600,000 and 1 million people were drowned as a result of this terrible cyclone. And these events are going to be more likely with climate change. What struck me as I dug into this report was the fact that I thought, oh, yes, maybe a few more women than men would have been impacted. But it horrified me to realize that it was actually, of that 1 million people, 90% of the deaths were women or girls, and mostly young women. And 90%. I really dug into that and tried to understand it. And just not to be on too sober a note, many of these women died by drowning. I'm happy to report that in that very place where this disaster occurred, a place called Cox's Bazaar, there is now today a fabulous women's swimming club, and women are being taught to swim. And our Australians, you know, we love water and love swimming. And we've now got a very successful program called Teach Girls to Swim right across the Pacific, so women can swim out at least. Because in this disaster, women actually didn't know how to swim. They were caught up in their saris and their hair, and they were often in restricted conditions, held back, and they were not picked up. So teaching women to swim is a great initiative. So I'd like to end on that positive note about climate change, but be aware of it and take it seriously, not just as a tokenistic, oh, let's do a gender impact assessment here. Think deeply about it.
So last question, and I like to ask this of all my guests, because I think they all bring unique perspectives given their unique research interests. So in just a few words or sentences, if you were to meet someone who knew nothing about minerals or mining, and in this case, maybe the artisanal small-scale mining sector, what would you tell them if they asked you, why do minerals matter or why do gemstones matter?
I'd say two things. I'd talk about the utility of minerals and the hidden utility of minerals. For example, if you look at hip replacements, or as we have an aging population or not aging, did you know that the hip replacement, the actual ball socket is made partly from cobalt and the shaft is made from titanium? These are all minerals that are mined both small scale and large scale. So the absolute utility, and these very minerals are the ones that are taking us into the next stage of creating electric cars and wind turbines and so on. They're needed in the new economy. So the utility, but also the beauty and the symbolic value of minerals. So I'll never forget, I used to go to the British Museum in London, and there was this amazing amount of objects that were thrown into the River Thames as votive offerings. And there was a shield that had been thrown in, made of beautiful brass with gold and gemstones, and had been thrown in since, you know, for thousands of years. Metals and gemstones have been objects of beauty and value and symbolic value for us as human beings. And I think that beauty of gemstones and gold is not lost on any culture. So they're the utility and the beauty is what I'd say.
Oh, I must say, it always fascinates me. If you really sit down and think about it and meet with communities and learn about these minerals, the stories that they can tell for hundreds and thousands of years, it's just incredible. The stories culturally, religious stories, spiritually, it's just minerals have always played an important role in our life, whether or not we realize that in today's technological, you know, of fast-paced cell phones and all the different technologies. Well, Linda, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast and having this very timely conversation about artisanal and small-scale mining, especially with women in the mining industry. I want to recommend everybody check out Dr. Lawson's research and also stay updated on the incredible work going on at the Sustainable Minerals Institute. Linda, I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week. I look forward to having you on the podcast again and continuing this conversation. And until next time, I'm your host, Thomas Hale, and thanks for joining us on another discussion at A Rock and a Hard Place. Thank you for joining us on another episode of A Rock and a Hard Place. Be sure to follow me on LinkedIn and check out our website, Mineral Choices, for more content. If you would like to be a guest on our podcast or contribute to our website, then please reach out. We love hearing from you, so do get in touch. And until next time, keep on rocking.